This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Revie.
All week, especially here in D.C., people were wondering, would the U.S. government shut down? All but essential services would stop, 800,000 federal workers would be furloughed without pay, and would soldiers be paid? It became a game of political chicken. Who would blink first? Late Friday night, it seemed everyone blinked a little. The crisis was suddenly over. Till the next crisis over government spending. We'll report and analyze. And later on this weekend roundup, Attorney General Eric Holder decides to put the alleged 9/11 planners on trial with military judges at Guantanamo. CBS's Bob Orr will report.
Just 17 months ago, Holder pledged to prosecute KSM and four Al-Qaeda co-defendants in a civilian court just blocks from New York's Ground Zero.
We'll also go to Japan. A powerful aftershock caused more damage. And in Libya, a stalemate. CBS News correspondent Alan Pizzi talking with disorganized rebels who want more from the U.S. and NATO.
The main message was blunt. Extend the campaign to bomb the Libyan army no matter how close it is to civilian areas, and don't worry if mistakes are made.
More on that coming up, and an interview with two former CIA spies who met undercover, now married to each other. And a lot more news, but we begin with the federal government unable to spend money. Without another extension passed by Congress, spending authority was running out Friday night at midnight. CBS News correspondent Bob Fuss at the Capitol after that long day Friday.
The final deal came just 1 hour before a government shutdown was set to begin, the kind of brinksmanship Congress often engages in when the disagreements are serious and no one wants to compromise. House Speaker John Boehner was the first to announce the deal after convincing his fellow Republicans, including Tea Party freshmen, that it was the best he could get.
I'm pleased that Senator Reid and I and the White House have been able to come to an agreement that will, in fact, cut spending and keep our government open.
Republicans won $38 billion in spending cuts. They wanted 60, but Democrats didn't want any. Democrats won the policy arguments. Republicans can't cut off funds for health reform, women's health clinics, or enforcement of environmental laws. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid.
Both sides have had to make tough choices. But tough choices are what this job's all about.
The measure will cut $38 billion from spending over the next 6 months and leave health reform, pollution laws, and family planning clinics as they are.
As for the spending cut of $38.5 billion in the coming 6 months, that's a 2% reduction in planned government spending, less than Republicans demanded, more than Democrats wanted to give. And President Obama had started after the November elections by proposing a freeze in spending levels. He did get involved in these negotiations, though critics said, what took him so long? This past week, Mr. Obama invited the top Republican, Speaker of the House Boehner, and the Senate Democratic leader Reid to the White House again and again for private talks. CBS News correspondent Whit Johnson at the White House reports.
Friday, the Speaker and the President had three telephone conversations, and at one point we're told the President said, hey, you're the Speaker, I'm the President, we're the two most consequential figures in American government. It's going to be up to us to get this deal done. And in fact, when an agreement was reached at 11:25, there was a fourth phone conversation. This time the President called the Speaker to say thank you.
Yes, the logjam was broken that late on Friday night. House Speaker Boehner announced the deal. Then President Obama delivered an obviously pre-written speech about it, not simply an announcement. A part of that speech from the White House?
Americans of different beliefs came together again. In the final hours before our government would have been forced to shut down, leaders in both parties reached an agreement that will allow our small businesses to get the loans they need, our families to get the mortgages they applied for, and hundreds of thousands of Americans to show up at work.
Stay tuned to this weekend roundup. We'll have more of President Obama's speech from late Friday night. On Thursday, CBS TV stations had reporters looking at projects that Republicans were pushing to reduce or eliminate in these cash-strapped times.
I'm Natasha Brown in Philadelphia at one of 820 Planned Parenthood centers around the country. Republicans want to cut $75 million in funding Planned Parenthood receives because abortions are performed at some of the centers. Democrats say the federal money goes toward birth control and gynecological exams, not abortion.
I'm Mary Bubala on the Chesapeake Bay watershed in Maryland. Republicans want to block about $40 million in funding to clean up this polluted waterway. They also want to roll back EPA limits on arsenic, mercury, and other toxic chemicals in the air and water. Regulations they say stifle economic growth.
Let's turn to CBS News correspondent Bob Fuss covering Congress. Bob, as the clock ticked away, the days, the hours, then the minutes to Friday night at midnight, what were the big issues and were they big separating the two sides?
The Democrats and Republicans were spinning wildly during the final hours of negotiation, each stressing an issue they felt made them look better. For the Republicans, they were insisting it was all about money, saying the Democrats simply weren't willing to cut spending enough, and they said that's what they cared about and what they were elected to do. The Senate Democrats were saying they had already agreed on spending cuts to satisfy Republicans. They were balking over social issues having nothing to do with money.
Now, several Democrats, Bob, said the top Republican, House Speaker Boehner, was being guided or boxed in or pushed around by newly elected House members who consider themselves Tea Party members. True?
Well, there's certainly some truth to that. Back when this started, the Republican House leaders came up with a proposal for about $30 billion in spending cuts for the rest of the year. And the Tea Party freshmen just revolted, and they made them go back and double that number to $60 billion, which was the number they used when they started negotiating with the Democrats.
Oh, so Republican Paul Ryan kind of changed the subject the other day. He's chairman of the House Budget Committee, and he looked ahead to fiscal 2012, the year that starts this coming October, and Ryan proposed a Republican version of a full-year budget that obviously is going to be very controversial for many months.
You know, that's going to make this fight look like small potatoes. He's talking about trillions of dollars with a T that he wants to cut from the federal budget.
At the Capitol, CBS News correspondent Bob Fuss. Thanks for the long hours, and take care, Bob.
Thank you, Dan.
Now some positive news about the economy. CBS's Gary Nunn reports.
Lines are a bit shorter at unemployment offices around the country. The number of people applying for first-time benefits fell last week by 10,000 to a level of 382,000. That is slightly shy of expectations. It's the third decline in 4 weeks. Economist David Weiss.
Employment is always a lagging indicator. It always turns around later than people think.
Gary Nunn, CBS News.
In foreign news, unrest in Arab countries has spread to Syria, tough enemy of Israel and ally of Iran. Tens of thousands of demonstrators in one Syrian city on Friday. Security forces opened fire. At least 16 people were killed, hundreds wounded. Rula Amin reports from Syria for Al Jazeera.
It shows that the people in Daraa are still as angry as they were 3 weeks ago. People are frustrated. They feel that their demands have not been met, despite government promises to deal with their issues. They wanted those responsible for the earlier killings to be held responsible. That didn't happen yet. They want the emergency law to be lifted. That didn't happen yet.
Up next, terrorism trials, then fighting in Libya.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
9.5 years after the attacks of 9/11, the Attorney General Eric Holder has decided to put the alleged masterminds on trial in military commissions at the controversial Guantanamo base on the island of Cuba. The plan till now had been to put KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and other men alleged to be al-Qaeda terrorists on trial in federal court in New York City. Many New Yorkers didn't want the security concerns and other disruption that would be caused. Members of Congress sought to cut off any funding for transporting terror suspects from Guantanamo into the U.S. On this major change in plans to use military commissions, CBS News correspondent Bob Orr on Monday.
I believe that they can deliver fair trials and just verdicts.
Just 17 months ago, Holder pledged to prosecute KSM and four al-Qaeda co-defendants in a civilian court just blocks from New York's Ground Zero. Holder did not hide his frustration.
I know this case in a way that members of Congress do not. I have looked at the files. I've spoken to the prosecutors. So do I know better than them? Yes.
And military commissions.
The festering flap over where to try Mohammed has angered families of 9/11 victims. Geraldine Davey has been seeking justice for her daughter for nearly a decade.
I owe this to Amy. I need justice for my 23-year-old who was slaughtered that day. And we cannot forget them.
KSM, the highest-profile al-Qaeda detainee at Gitmo, has admitted planning dozens of plots. and he is one of three alleged terrorists to be waterboarded by CIA interrogators. Justice Department memos reveal Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times in the month after his capture in March 2003. In a Gitmo military court 3 years ago, KSM denounced his treatment as torture, telling the military judge he wanted the death penalty. "That is what I wish," Mohammed said. "I wish to be martyred for a long time." It's not clear if military prosecutors will pursue the death penalty.
CBS's Bob Orr here in Washington. Now the latest on the military campaign in Libya. Looks like a stalemate. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and his government forces advance against rebels, mostly in eastern Libya. Then the rebels push forward. Apparently there are dozens of deaths every day. Testifying to Congress, the U.S. General in Charge of Africa Command, Carter Ham, said calling it a stalemate seems about right for now. And about the rebels, when General Ham was asked if al-Qaeda men could be among them?
"We have seen intent expressed by al-Qaeda in the lands of the Islamic Maghreb, by the Libyan Islamic Fighter Group and others to partner with the opposition, if you will."
So would he favor the NATO alliance led by the U.S. sending in weapons and providing training?
"Not without a better understanding of exactly who the opposition force is."
More from CBS News correspondent Cammy McCormick.
General Carter Ham advised against making regime change a military objective, still under questioning from Senator Lindsey Graham.
"Would you agree with me that if he were neutralized or taken out of the fight through kinetic activity, it would end this whole conflict rather quickly?"
Sir, his removal by any means would end this relatively quickly.
Ham also wouldn't rule out troops on the ground to end a possible stalemate.
"That is certainly one potential outcome of this, of an international force of some composition intervening between the regime and the opposition forces."
Cammy McCormick, CBS News, Washington.
In Libya on Monday, CBS News correspondent Alan Pizzi reported the rebels need and want help from the U.S. and its allies.
The main message was blunt: extend the campaign to bomb the Libyan army no matter how close it is to civilian areas, and don't worry if mistakes are made.
"What happens if they kill innocent people?"
"We don't care. This is shahid.
Martyrs."
Even those who set up this rally know the rebels can't win without help. And there are reports that the political and military factions of the revolt have reached an accord.
"The rebel military council says it now has a functioning command structure, a list of specific weapons they want, and a core of professionals who can be both trusted and trained to use them quickly."
Fears that Western-supplied firepower could end up in the hands of chaotic volunteers running up and down the road are misplaced, according to the spokesman for what is now called the Free Libya Forces.
"Now the anti-tanks and anti-cannons also, plus the most important thing is that the communication systems, you know."
The Libyan army is using Russian-made military hardware to batter towns like Misrata and Brega. The rebels want Western weapons.
"We will need advisors and instructors just to show us how to use it. It takes time, not more than a week, I think."
That may be as optimistic as asking NATO to provide close air support for rebel fighters.
CBS's Alan Pizzi. NATO officers confirm, after first denying it, that a NATO air attack destroyed a tank operated by rebels. Obviously, there's a problem in marking who's on the side we're supporting and who is not. Now to Japan. 4 weeks after the terrible 9.0 earthquake, the tsunami that followed, and now radiation leaking from nuclear power plants, there's been another quake. An aftershock, a strong one, magnitude 7.1, just east of already devastated Sendai. CBS News correspondent Celia Hatton was 200 miles to the south in Tokyo on Thursday.
"I felt the earthquake that struck northeast Japan around 11:45 p.m. local time. In Tokyo, our entire office tower swayed for over a minute, causing the walls to creak as they shook back and forth."
Three people died. Half a million households lost power. The damaged nuclear power plants did not sustain much more leakage, but the problem of neutralizing the nuclear fuel inside remains. And Celia Hatton's report on one particular town reminds us there's still widespread suffering.
"When the tsunami hit the coastal village of Minami-Soma, the damage was unthinkable. But it wasn't until 2 weeks later that a new threat forced townspeople to issue a desperate call for help on the internet. I beg you, as mayor of Minami Soma City, to help us, says Katsunobu Sakurai. Just 15 miles from the crippled Daiichi nuclear complex, the 20,000 who didn't flee the town were ordered to stay indoors to avoid radiation. No one dared to truck in food or fuel. The people are literally drying up as if they are under starvation tactics. His plea went viral. Within days, groups of volunteers drove there to donate supplies, despite the threat of radiation. Celia Hatton, CBS News, Tokyo.
CBS News correspondent Vicky Barker traveled to see vast destruction still unrepaired.
A highway rest stop in northern Japan, listing all of the roads still closed 4 weeks after the earthquake and tsunami. Inside the tsunami zone, entire roads and railroad lines have been washed away. That's slowing the flow of food and medicine to the displaced, and it's slowed and sometimes stopped the flow of Japanese goods to market, both at home and abroad. The already struggling Japanese economy didn't need this. Vicky Barker, CBS News, Tokyo.
Up next, assigning blame in the government shutdown game of chicken.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
Now some background to the huge dispute here in Washington, D.C., as the federal government appeared to stumble its way toward a shutdown on Friday night. The blame game was loud and clear. This is what CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer said to Harry Smith on the CBS Evening News on Thursday.
You know, I think at first, Harry, it's not going to make all that much difference because it will come on the weekend. I mean, they'll close the National Zoo. People in Washington, for example, won't get parking tickets because they are going to lay off the people that get parking tickets. But if this goes on into next week and it starts inconveniencing people, I think you are going to see outrage like we have never seen before. Because let's not forget, Congress has been in session since January. And up until this point, they have accomplished absolutely nothing. And you're going to see a reaction to that like you've never seen.
They're really kind of starting to play with fire here if they do shut this government down.
They're not looking for a way to either keep the government open or shut it down. We're into a blame game now. Both sides are trying to blame the other side if the government does shut down. They've got to get off that and get to thinking about the people that sent them to Washington to represent them. This is a shameful episode in the history of the Congress. And I think if this government does shut down for any length of time, people are not going to look for who to blame. They're going to blame all of them.
CBS's Bob Schieffer. Now to Bob Gates, the defense secretary, making what's expected to be his last trip to Iraq to visit U.S. troops. He spoke to some of them about the prospects of a government shutdown.
You will be paid. You know, as a historian, it always occurred to me that a smart thing for government was always to pay the guys with guns first.
Soldiers and other government employees were worried, but the crisis was averted. They will be paid. President Obama gave that news from the White House after 11 p.m. Eastern Time Friday.
Behind me, through the window, you can see the Washington Monument. The people who travel here come to learn about our history and to be inspired by the example of our democracy. A place where citizens of different backgrounds and beliefs can still come together as one nation. Tomorrow, I'm pleased to announce that the Washington Monument, as well as the entire federal government, will be open for business. And that's because today, Americans of different beliefs came together again. In the final hours before our government would have been forced to shut down, leaders in both parties reached an agreement that will allow our small businesses to get the loans they need, our families to get the mortgages they applied for, and hundreds of thousands of Americans to show up at work and take home their paychecks on time, including our brave men and women in uniform. This agreement between Democrats and Republicans, on behalf of all Americans, is on a budget that invests in our future while making the largest annual spending cut in our history. Like any worthwhile compromise, both sides had to make tough decisions and give ground on issues that were important to them. And I certainly did that. Some of the cuts we agreed to will be painful. Programs people rely on will be cut back. Needed infrastructure projects will be delayed. And I would not have made these cuts in better circumstances. But beginning to live within our means is the only way to protect those investments that will help America compete for new jobs. investments in our kids' education and student loans, in clean energy and life-saving medical research. We protected the investments we need to win the future. At the same time, we also made sure that at the end of the day, this was a debate about spending cuts, not social issues like women's health and the protection of our air and water. These are important issues that deserve discussion, just not during a debate about our budget. I want to thank Speaker Boehner and Senator Reid for their leadership and their dedication during this process. A few months ago, I was able to sign a tax cut for American families because both parties worked through their differences and found common ground. Now the same cooperation will make possible the biggest annual spending cut in history. And it's my sincere hope that we can continue to come together as we face the many difficult challenges that lie ahead, from creating jobs and growing our economy to educating our children and reducing our deficit. That's what the American people expect us to do. That's why they sent us here.
Most of President Obama's speech from Friday night. Now to the true story of two CIA undercover officers who fell in love, now married to each other, Robert Baer, who writes a lot about intelligence matters, and his wife, Dana Baer, authors of a memoir called The Company We Keep. Dana, just to be clear, neither of you works for the U.S. government now.
Correct.
All right. And when you found each other, you both were in the CIA.
Yes.
So, well, how much are you able to reveal? Like, where were you when you met?
Well, we met in Sarajevo, actually in the middle of a war zone. I was sent to support Bob's work there, and we were tracking Hezbollah.
Tracking Hezbollah? Now, Bob, wait a second. Those are thought of as Lebanese Shiite Muslim militants. What were they doing in Sarajevo, Yugoslavia?
The Iranians use them when they don't want to get caught. They were surveilling Americans. There was an attempt on a CIA operative to grab him, and that's why we went in, try to stop these guys and see who they were going after next.
All right. Were you both carrying guns as part of your usual work on the Sarajevo mission?
Well, I was. Part of my training had been protective operations.
So that's a yes from Dana. Bob?
I don't think they trusted me with a gun. I ended up shooting myself in the foot.
No, so really? But on some of your missions, yes? No? You were an intel...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I used to carry one in Lebanon. It was, you couldn't go out in the street without a gun, without an automatic rifle.
Now, you understand many of our listeners will say, oh, no wonder they found each other sexy, a man and a woman, undercover work, weapons. But Bob, among other things... Is it true? In the book, it says you did not even know Dana's real name as you worked with her.
No, I knew her as Riley. I figured it was an alias and just never asked, hey, what's your real name? It's not the way it works.
Now, both of you were married before, and Bob, I can't even imagine that you have a wife and you're not able to tell her what you really do and where you're going. And typically, how long would you be away?
I'd be away for a year at a time. My kids didn't know I even worked for the CIA until I was on a 60 Minutes piece and saw me on TV. And Dana will tell you, you know, she was just gone, couldn't email home, couldn't call home. You just basically disappeared.
You're working in a completely different name, so you really become a totally different person.
So, Dana, what were you, a true patriot who put country before personal life?
No, I don't know what I thought I was getting into, really, when I joined the CIA, but it was an adventure. There's definitely an allure to it. I love to travel.
So at the start, you thought you could make that work, being somebody's wife and having this job. At the beginning, you thought it could work.
Sure, I thought it could work, and I can look at it in hindsight and say, you know, now the second I took the job, it was the beginning of the end of my marriage.
Dana Baer with Robert Baer, co-authors of a new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife, True Life Spy Story. Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Raviv.
Let's explore the unrest in Arab countries in the Middle East and North Africa with Paul Bremer, a U.S. diplomat since the 1970s. His last post was coordinator, some say practically governor of Iraq. after the U.S. invaded Iraq 8 years ago and toppled Saddam Hussein. I asked retired Ambassador Bremer if he would contend that the war in Iraq, though it became controversial, may have paved the way toward rebellions against longtime dictators in other Arab countries.
Well, there have been some indications that some of the people in Egypt and the demonstrations at Tahrir Square may have had it in the back of their minds. Some of them said they did. The example of what had happened in what, after all, is the other major Arab country, which is Iraq. So it had some impact on them. Of course, everybody also saw how hard it was in Iraq.
Well, what do you think that many Arab citizens who want freedom think? They look at what happened in Iraq, and frankly, I think many of them don't like what the U.S. did, except for the part of getting rid of the dictator.
The Iraqis are better off today than they were under Saddam Hussein. He was really a monster. In many ways, getting rid of the tyrant, ironically, is the easy part. It's building the country afterwards, after a tyrant has been around for 20, 30, or 40 years. That's the hard part.
You're no longer in U.S. government service, so offer the advice from the outside. Given the current circumstances and after the experience in Iraq, somewhat bitter, what can and should the U.S. do in those other countries that do have to make this transition?
I think the first thing is to recognize how hard it is and that you need time. You need to be patient. An interim government is going to have to be put together, as it has been in a way in Egypt, by the military. You have to put in place some kind of political scaffolding so that the country has a way to organize itself. Now, in the case of Egypt, they opted not to write a new constitution immediately. They've sort of fiddled with the old one. That may turn out to be a mistake. It may have been better to take the time to get a new constitution, as we did in Iraq. And above all, you need to provide security.
Former Ambassador Paul Bremer now is president of World Team Sports, a nonprofit organization. What is World Team Sports?
It's been around for 20 years, and our main mission is we do athletic events for disabled citizens. We do mountain climbing, whitewater rafting, biking, sled hockey, you name it. We've done lots of things over the last 20 years.
Well, if I can think for a second, especially about military personnel, men and women who've suffered terrible injuries, and for the rest of their life they'll never be the same, this is very empowering for them.
It's enormously empowering for anybody who's disabled, because what happens in a sporting event is the disabled person develops self-confidence again. I was with 16 wounded warriors last summer. We rode from the Bay Bridge in San Francisco to Virginia Beach, 4,000 miles, 64 days, with 16 of these men and women. And it was the most impressive thing I've ever seen, to see these people with one arm or one leg and riding hand bikes because they were paralyzed from the waist down, going across the Sierra Nevadas and the Rockies and the Alleghenies. It puts your own life in perspective pretty quickly. You stop complaining.
Now, anyone listening to this may wonder, how do you finance World Team Sports?
Well, we are a nonprofit, so we're financed effectively by donations by individuals and corporations. And you can go to our website. It's www.worldteamsports.org. Of course, we welcome donations.
Former Ambassador Paul Bremer, now president of World Team Sports. Now to the stunning story of Wilbert Rideau, a former death row inmate imprisoned in Louisiana for 44 years. A retrial canceled the death penalty, though he was convicted of manslaughter. Rideau was released 6 years ago. Now he's the winner of the George Polk Award for Special Reporting. He edited a magazine inside the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola and exposed abuses.
I'm Gary Nunn. Wilbur Rideau, at age 69, is not bitter, having spent more than half of his life in prison. He was stunned to learn that he would actually receive his George Polk Award after 32 years.
It's fantastic. It's difficult to overstate what the award meant to me. You know, a high school dropout, an eighth grade dropout, a self-taught journalist who's operating with no real frame of reference. Nobody taught me to be a journalist or to operate a magazine.
Since his release 6 years ago, he has consulted defense attorneys and lectured about journalism, trying to bridge the gap between prison perception and reality inside and out.
Most prisoners don't live like that. I was in the bloodiest prison in the country. You had gangs, you had sexual violence, you had all, you name it, it was going on. The majority of prisoners did not engage in any of that.
Rideau says jailhouse journalism is a tedious job.
The administration. They want you to be a PR, a peace firm, and tell everybody how great they are and everything you want in life. On the flip side of the coin is the prisoners, who they want to use you as a journalistic gun to shoot the administration with.
Life magazine called him the most rehabilitated prisoner in America.
Governor Edwin Edwards, in 1986, when he was denying commutation from your pardon, he said himself that he believed that I was fully rehabilitated. And if he did the right thing, he'd free me. He didn't.
Since his release, Rideau has written his autobiography and co-directed a documentary, which was nominated for an Oscar. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
Now we salute the baseball season with CBS's Jim Taylor from his series called Now What?
Talking baseball.
Baseball begins in the spring, the season of new life. Baseball.
I just think it's a great sport. It's a lot more academic, I think, than people realize. The nuance of the game, like whether or not what kind of pitch the pitcher is about to throw, will determine whether the second baseman versus the shortstop will take the throw if the runner on first is going to steal. And the relationship between the pitcher and the catcher is so important.
Baseball is a 19th century pastoral game.
It's the American sport, and I am a Yankees fan, and I love watching it. I one day have a dream of going to Yankee Stadium. I've never been. I've never been.
In baseball, during the game in the stands, there's kind of a picnic feeling.
I'm not a big fan of baseball, but I do enjoy the hot dogs.
Baseball is played in a park. The baseball park.
Like to me, two strikes, two outs, and the batter fouls it off. To me, that you're just getting on the edge of your seat all over again. Like you live and die with every single pitch. And to me, that's a fantastic sport.
Baseball has no time limit. We don't know when it's going to end. We might have extra innings.
A team could be down 20 runs and still, in theory, win. So it might be improbable, but it's not impossible. With a time sport, it's impossible.
Growing up, my mom would always take me to baseball games. But we weren't there to watch baseball. We were there, as she put it, to watch the butts. Because they wear very tight pants. That's all I remember. Butts and handlebar mustaches.
In baseball, the object is to go home. And to be safe. I hope I'll be safe at home.
Here's the play of the plate. Holy cow, I think he's going to make it.
Now what? Jim Taylor, CBS News.
From the diamond to the courts, in a moment we'll shift to championship basketball.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
TV ratings for college basketball were very high this year as March Madness, the NCAA tournament, spilled over into April. The men's championship game was this past Monday night.
This is Steve Futterman in Houston. It was the hat trick for UConn.
The UConn Huskies are the top dog in the 2011 Final Four.
The call on Westwood One. It was not the best played championship game, far from it. Both teams had problems making baskets. UConn wasn't red hot, but Butler was ice cold. Still, for the team that won, could this less than beautiful game still be a thing of beauty? UConn coach Jim Calhoun said yes as he talked about how both teams gave it their all.
To me, that's beauty. That's what this game should be about. That's what this game should be about. And yeah, you'd like a few more baskets made, certainly, but it was two teams that weren't going to give in to each other, and finally our superiority took over. But damn, I loved it in the sense of the fact of the fight and competitiveness between the two teams.
Butler had the worst shooting night in championship game history, making 12 of 64 shots. Its coach Brad Stevens tried to be philosophical.
You're not always going to make shots. That's part of the game. Very rarely will you go 12 of 64.
For UConn's Jim Calhoun, he becomes only the fifth coach to win three or more titles, joining a select group that includes UCLA's John Wooden and Bobby Knight. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Houston.
Now some fascinating findings about HRT, hormone replacement therapy. Women, usually older women, have to think about health risks from pills or patches that are meant to help.
I'm Barry Bagnato, CBS News in Washington.
For women dealing with hot flashes and other symptoms of menopause, it hasn't been easy determining whether hormone replacement therapy is a step worth taking. Headline-grabbing studies have warned of serious health risks, especially heart attacks and strokes. Now, as part of a respected long-term study, researchers in Seattle suggest the risks fade over time after therapy stops. They focused on the effects of using estrogen alone instead of in combination with progestin.
For heart disease overall, we found no difference either during the intervention, at the end of the intervention, or at the end of this longer-term follow-up period, no difference between the estrogen group and the group of women that took a placebo pill.
But Dr. Andrea LaCroix of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center notes,
the effect of estrogen on heart disease differed significantly by age.
Women in their 50s had fewer heart attacks overall. Women in their 70s had more. An editorial accompanying this study in the Journal of the American Medical Association calls this surprising result inconsistent with a long-standing corroborated body of evidence. It advises caution. First of all, it says 68% of the women in the study began their estrogen-only therapy after the age of 60, so the breast cancer risk reduction may not be as applicable to women who started in their 50s. Secondly, the editorialists say, the median time women in the estrogen-only group stuck with their therapy was 3.5 years. Longer-term use, they suggest, could pose risks not found in the study. So what should a woman make of all this? Anyone considering hormone replacement therapy should talk thoroughly with her doctor about potential risks and benefits that would impact her as an individual. And anyone thinking about estrogen-only therapy, like the treatment reviewed in this study, must keep in mind it can only be used after a hysterectomy. If a woman does not have her uterus removed, hormone replacement therapy must include progestin. Barry Bagnetto, CBS News, Washington.
Now a wake-up call to American parents. Your youngsters don't think it's a big deal to get drunk every day and use illegal drugs. This in a new survey from the partnership at drugfree.org, surveying 2,500 teens, finding an increase in binge drinking and getting high. CBS News correspondent Ben Tracy reports.
At a music rave like this one in Los Angeles, thousands of teenagers were drunk and high. 15-year-old Sasha Rodriguez drank water laced with ecstasy. She later overdosed and died. It may seem shocking, but in the last 3 years, ecstasy use among teenagers has jumped 67%. 1 in 10 teens now uses it. Marijuana use is up 22%, with 4 in 10 teens smoking pot.
Does that surprise any of you?
No.
No.
Not at all?
No.
These high school students say marijuana is not taboo.
People look down upon somebody who smokes cigarettes more than they look down upon weed.
As for alcohol, 71% of teens have a drink before they leave high school. On average, they start at just 14 years old, 25% of them by age 12.
When did you first see alcohol?
Seventh grade.
Yeah.
Seventh grade?
The teens we talk to say drinking and smoking pot isn't something that just happens on the weekends at parties. They say it happens all week long.
There's people that do it after school, during school, on the weekends.
You come and relax after the party by getting high and drinking. It's
prom.
Never ending.
A nonstop party that can turn deadly. Ben Tracy, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Let's hear some voice auditions now. The insurance company that uses a duck in its ads looking for a new voice. CBS's Mark Strassman has our report.
Affleck.
Think of it as American Idol.
And I am the next Affleck Duck.
Meets Animal Planet.
Affleck!
A national audition to find the voice of Affleck's next
Affleck.
Spokes duck.
Affleck!
The one Americans heard in 10,000 commercials a year.
What'd you say? Affleck!
The star of the company's $100 million plus advertising budget.
Why not? Why not me?
Affleck!
New Yorker Bradley Ellison has the gravelly voice.
Affleck!
I think I'm good. I think I'm like one of the final 10.
After 11 years, last month the Affleck duck lost the only voice it ever had.
Affleck!
Shock comedian Gilbert Gottfried. Gottfried offended Affleck with jokes about Japanese tsunami victims.
Affleck!
By month's end, the company
Affleck.
Will pick a new voice. Mark Strassman, CBS News, Atlanta.
Speaking of jobs, in a serious vein, our weekend roundup commentator, Charles Grodin.
A story in the New York Times by Lizette Alvarez about a 61-year-old man in Florida who's a cabinet maker and is unemployed, put a bright spotlight on what it's like for those in America who want to work and just can't get a job. Richard Dudenhofer had applied for job after job after job and never has been granted even an interview, never gotten an email, no flicker of hope. He said he sold his gun because it was too tempting to end his life. He was so depressed. This is the plight of millions of people in America. It too often feels we are turning our backs on them. We must not do that. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Anytime you want to hear this broadcast, please do an internet search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts. And to hear news and features nonstop, there's an iPhone app, CBS Radio News. Or go to radio.com, click news, then find CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Raviv. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.